Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Republicans debate, talk of government shutdown, and borders closing to migrants in Europe. At the GOP debate, Carly Fiorina swung back at Donald Trump when asked about comments he made in a magazine interview about her appearance, her face. Trump has said his comments were about her persona. Fiorina had the line of the night.
I think women all over this country heard very clearly what Mr. Trump said.
On Monday, liberal presidential candidate Bernie Sanders made his pitch for Common Ground at conservative Liberty University.
There is no justice when so few have so much and so many have so little.
And thousands of migrants, refugees, are looking for new routes through Europe as countries close their borders. It was rough at the border of Croatia and Hungary as migrants broke through a barricade yesterday. This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Lisa Desjardins of PBS NewsHour, Ramesh Panaru of Bloomberg News, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What do you see in the GOP, in Bernie Sanders, at Liberty U, on Europe's borders? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With me from Arlington, Virginia today is Lisa Desjardins, political director for PBS NewsHour. Lisa, welcome back. Great to have you here.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
Also with us from Arlington is Ramesh Panaru. He's a columnist at Bloomberg View and senior editor at National Review. Ramesh, welcome back to you as well. Great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Lisa, and Ramesh.
Let's jump right into that GOP debate. Fiorina and Trump went at one another on their business records. Here was Carly Fiorina taking aim at Donald Trump's record.
The way you ran your casinos, you ran up mountains of debt as well as losses using other people's money, and you were forced to file for bankruptcy not once.
I never filed
not
for
twice,
bankruptcy.
Four times, a record four times. Why should we trust you?
Not personal, but it was a business. They were business bankruptcies. The billionaire came right back. Trump ran after Carly Fiorina's record as a business executive, focusing on her time as CEO at Hewlett-Packard.
The company is a disaster and continues to be a disaster. They still haven't recovered. Now, one other company before that was Lucent. Carly was at Lucent before that. And Lucent turned out to be a catastrophe also. So I only say this. She can't run any of my companies.
Enough already, said New Jersey Governor Chris Christie.
While I'm as entertained as anyone by this personal back and forth about the history of Donald and Carly's career, for the 55-year-old construction worker out in that audience tonight who doesn't have a job, who can't fund his child's education, I got to tell you the truth. They could care less about your careers. They care about theirs.
Ramesh Panaru, you've got a thoughtful conservative bent. You're watching these debates and more. What do you think of the GOP field and how it's emerging?
Well, I think it's a moment of transition. I suppose that's always true. I thought that Donald Trump was less dominant during the second debate than he was during the first debate on Fox News. There were long stretches during the CNN debate where you could even forget that Trump was there. I think the electricity on the stage belonged to Carly Fiorina this time, and she did a very good job of really sort of putting him in his place and even cowing him. So it'll be interesting to see how Trump's fans react, because so much of his appeal has been that he's the alpha male, he's dominating everything, and what happens to that appeal when he's not.
Fiorina was going kind of alpha herself. Donald Trump had said he would talk to Vladimir Putin of Russia, he would get along with him. Here's Fiorina.
Having met Vladimir Putin, I wouldn't talk to him at all. We've talked way too much to him. What I would do immediately is begin rebuilding the Sixth Fleet. I would begin rebuilding the missile defense program in Poland. I would conduct regular, aggressive military exercises in the Baltic states. I'd probably send a few thousand more troops into Germany. Vladimir Putin would get the message.
Lisa Desjardins, here was Carly Fiorina. She talked her way onto this stage, and she made use of every minute of her time.
That's right. And she wanted to display that she's someone who does her homework. That's what we saw in that bite, showing that she can be a strong military leader. We've seen some comparisons in the last day of her to Margaret Thatcher. And now, obviously, that's a comparison that she wants. She didn't get up there to be warm and friendly. She got up there to be a strong leader, which is where Donald Trump has been winning. And that's where she took some points from him. She was the only one to have landed a punch on him before. And what's interesting, Tom, is I think she still has more in her arsenal. She didn't even talk about Donald Trump's experience, which she sees as a lack of experience, his conservatism or his lack of conservatism. I think there's still a lot out there. And I think what we saw from Donald Trump that was interesting, I haven't heard a lot about, is he was trying to pivot in that same debate the opposite way. He was trying to come across as less combative, as more friendly and warm. But it was a moment that Carly Fiorina took advantage of at the same time.
Low fives, Jack Beatty, and bro handshakes with his neighbors Jeb Bush and Dr. Carson, Ben Carson, there on stage. There has been, you've talked about, sometimes almost a panic in certain Republican circles about Trump's ascendancy. Where do you see that this week, Jack?
Well, you know, the best one-liner on the debate came from an Iowa Republican insider. It was quoted by Politico, and it is, Carly Fiorina caused the fifth and final bankruptcy of Donald Trump. Well, we'll see. In their book, you know, on the 2012 campaign, political scientists John Sides and Lynn Vavreck, they see a pattern that may predict the end of the Trump boom. The discovery of media-sustained candidates like Trump is followed by media scrutiny, which is followed by decline. Discovery, scrutiny, decline. Well, Trump got plenty of critical scrutiny at Wednesday's debate. Negative ads sponsored by the Club for Growth, they're going to augment it. And the debate introduced a new discovery, Carly Fiorina, to compete with him for the media spotlight. Scrutiny of her has already begun. According to today's LA Times, one of the GOP candidates has just been given a 219-page opposition research dossier on Fiorina, compiled by Barbara Boxer, who trounced Fiorina in the 2010 Senate race in California. A bruising contest is set to get rougher.
Ramesh, if Donald Trump, I mean, you said he's a what was it, a nuisance, not a nightmare, or something along those lines, from your conservative perspective. If he doesn't manage to hold on to this number one spot, if his rough appeal, his populist appeal doesn't hold, who do you see further back? I mean, it may. He's been surprising people so far. But if it doesn't, who do you see back in the pack who might move up, Ramesh?
Well, I think Ben Carson and Carly Fiorina are the most likely to become the dominant players in the national polling. But there's maybe a different pattern going on in the early states. In New Hampshire, John Kasich is making a real move, the governor of Ohio. And I think, you know, there is time in this race for several people to take the lead between now and the first vote. That's what we saw in 2011 and 2012 on the Republican side. And if we start to see somebody like Carson or Fiorina overtake Trump in some of these polls, then I would think that that is a sign that we're going to see something of the same pattern. That is, Republican voters nationwide giving a hearing to each candidate serially.
I wonder how you see it, Ramesh. I mean, the three that you named there are all the outsider, the newcomers, not politicians. Ben Carson never had elected office, and right on down the line here. Are you, in your heart of hearts, thinking, you know, sooner or later this is going to come back to the political players in this crowd, or this could be the breakout, you know, a different year where it goes to truly one of these outsiders?
I think it is highly unlikely that the Republican Party is going to nominate somebody who has never held elective office. The last time it did that, it chose a candidate who had something else going for him, which is having won World War II. As impressive as Ben Carson and Carly Fiorina are in their ways, I don't think that they have anything in their resumes that stacks up against that. So I think that people are going to want to hear what they have to say and maybe give them a bigger platform. But at the end of the day, I believe that they're going to go with a politician.
Nathaniel's calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Nathaniel, what did you hear? What do you see?
Thank you. I thought that in spite of some people saying Marco Rubio had a very good night, which and he was certainly out there, he actually showed a lack of leadership when it came to global warming, in spite of the fact that his own state is likely, which is Florida, is likely to be more impacted than other ones. He backed off to follow the party line, which, by the way, still seemed to fail to acknowledge that one of Obama's international successes was bringing China, which was mentioned last night, into starting to deal with global warming.
Marco Rubio not going there. He did think about talk about global issues, kind of in a way to go after Donald Trump. Here was Rubio looking at foreign policy.
These are extraordinarily dangerous times that we live in. And the next president of the United States better be someone that understands these issues and has good judgment about them.
If the outsiders don't hold, Lisa, who do you see well positioned?
Well, there we go. Marco Rubio. I think if you at this point, you have to look at this race more like the Belmont Stakes, the long race at this point. And you have to look at the horses that are holding their stamina in the back and who's going to be able to surge at the right moment. And I think Team Rubio certainly thinks that he's in that position. We'll see. You know, I think he did have a strong night in foreign policy. And I think as far as conservatives are concerned, they probably liked what he had to say on climate change, that he was talking about jobs and talking about over-regulation and concerns about that. I think Ted Cruz is another person who thinks that he can soar at the right moment. He's hoping as Donald Trump falls, although he would never say that, of course. So I think those are certainly two to watch. And I also think John Kasich, he's sort of taking the moderate, maybe practical mantle that Jeb Bush thought he owned. And he doesn't right now.
Jack, you say you cite this pattern of discovery, scrutiny and decline for outside players. Could this year be different or is this inexorable?
Well, it could be different. I mean, the polls suggest that Republicans want an outsider, but there's a streak of sense in the party, and perhaps that'll reassert itself. On the other hand, the polls also show some of these outsiders, Trump, are nearly even with Hillary Clinton in the polls. So it's not as if Republican establishment people can say, "Oh, he's a certain loser." The polls don't say that.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, the GOP debate, shutdown showdown on Capitol Hill, borders closing to Europe's migrants, refugees, and the Fed not budging on those short-term interest rates. Lisa Desjardins is with us from the PBS NewsHour. Ramesh Panaru is here from Bloomberg View and National Review. Jack Beatty's here. More to say about this field. Donald Trump, beyond the debate platform in New Hampshire last night, did not take issue with this question from an unidentified man in the audience coming down very broadly and hard on Muslims in America, American Muslims.
We have a problem in this country. It's called Muslims. We know our current president is one.
Right.
You know he's not even an American.
We need this
birth
question.
Certificate,
this is the
man.
First question.
But anyway, we have training camps growing where they want to kill us.
Mm-hmm.
That's my question. When can we get rid of it?
We're going to be looking at a lot of different things. And, you know, a lot of people are saying that, and a lot of people are saying that bad things are happening out there. We're going to be looking at that and plenty of other things.
Ramesh Panaru, we remember when John McCain stood up to a similar questioner in an audience in a different campaign cycle and stood on principle and said, wait a minute, let's go to truth here, what's true and what's not. Donald Trump did none of that.
No, and it's not really surprising. I mean, this is a man, Donald Trump, who, when asked a few weeks ago about a hate crime, which was apparently inspired by him, said that his supporters were passionate. So, you know, this is, I think, what you should expect from Donald Trump. It is part of his appeal, not just that he is sort of tolerant of what, this sort of obvious bigotry, but that he doesn't apologize, he doesn't give in to political correctness or politeness or common decency. And I think he's going to stick with that approach.
But does that mean that the GOP is giving into bigotry, Ramesh?
Well, I think it means that you've got a significant fraction of the Republican Party that finds this appealing. It's not, you know, 70% of Republicans or more aren't supporting Donald Trump. And I assume that, 30% or the 20 to 30% that is supporting him, not all of them are supporting him for the same reasons. I would like to think that this sort of thing will cause his numbers to decline, and perhaps we'll see that over the next few weeks.
Lisa, Trump fades away or the rest of the field gets more Trump-like?
I think, you know, remember how far ahead Trump is right now. So I think if he fades, you know, well, the question is how far does he fade? How serious is that fade and how does he handle it? But I do think what we saw in the debate and what we're seeing now in fundraising, which is very important, is the rest of the pack stepping up. And I think that's what's going to be interesting to sort out. You know, does Chris Christie gain anything or is it really going to be this sort of Rubio, Cruz, Bush, Kasich? You know, maybe some of these outsiders, Fiorina, who's getting a ton of attention and a ton of super PAC money at this moment. I think they all are rising. I think it's going to be hard for Donald Trump to go much higher. You know, that's when you're that far ahead, the only place to go is down.
Jack, it was hard to listen to that just broad smear of Muslims, of the president as not American, as a Muslim himself, and a candidate for the presidency just kind of nodding along. Yeah.
You know, Trump has scant interest in any other member of the species except himself, and he may not have taken in what that man said. But when a second man returned to the theme of those Muslim terrorist training camps, Trump pandered to his paranoia. Lindsey Graham says 25% of Republicans believe Obama is a Muslim, quote, because they hate him so much. A much-cited poll suggests that half of Republicans believe that, quote, deep down, Obama is a Muslim. So is this incident going to cost Trump in the polls, or will it just help him consolidate a hate vote that's bigger than we ever imagined?
Steve in Providence, Rhode Island. Steve, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, I'd love the panel to thanks for taking the call, Tom.
Yeah.
Love the panel to comment on the following, and that is that I hear not one of these 15 or 14 or 17 or however many of them are left Republicans invoking, let's go back to the wonderful days of Bush 2, 2001 to 2009. Weren't they the glory days? They invoke Reagan, but we all know that they don't reside anywhere near what Reagan represented and that he wouldn't even be on the stage with them today. So what is the Republican Party? You know, Obama didn't overly invoke the Clinton years, but he certainly didn't deny the good years of Clinton, which was the 8 years in between when he was running and, you know. Clinton.
Yeah. Steve, why do you say Ronald Reagan would not have been anywhere on this stage? I mean, after all, they were in his library last night. Why wouldn't he have fit on the stage? By your lights.
Because I think we all know that his overall philosophy, his overall attitude, he wouldn't be in the mud with this kind of ad hominem, you know, attacking kind of stuff. He was a person, ironically, of, you know, of fairly big ideas that he just, you know, kept hammering.
Yep.
And had a stature about him, ironically, as a Republican, that none of these folks, you know, philosophically or otherwise, align with at all.
Ramesh, how do you respond on where the GOP stands today, the sort of gapping out of the eight George W. years and the Reagan comparison or distance therefrom?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would note, actually, that Jeb Bush's biggest applause line of the night was when he applauded his brother, George W. Bush, for having kept America safe following September 11th. And that was an interesting move because, of course, George W. Bush left office very unpopular. And the Bush legacy and the idea of a Bush dynasty has generally been considered one of the things that's holding Jeb Bush back. And I should note here for the record that my wife works for Jeb Bush's campaign.
Okay.
On the general question of whether Reagan would fit in, I think there's, you know, look, times change and parties change. You know, JFK would be considered kind of a hawkish tax cutter to be a Democrat today. In Reagan's case, he raised taxes as president. He signed a liberal abortion law as governor of California. He, of course, signed what a lot of Republicans today call an amnesty on immigration. Now, I think partly it's because Reagan himself changed his party that the party is more conservative than it was when he was in office, and it doesn't have to compromise in some ways on some issues the way he did. And I think a lot of Republicans would say that they learned from the failure of the Reagan amnesty for enforcement of the immigration laws to be delivered on. But I think the caller is absolutely right that that parties do change.
Here's Jeb Bush on Wednesday night. Trump, Donald Trump had said that George W. Bush was to blame for the election of Barack Obama. Jeb came back like so.
As it relates to my brother, there's one thing I know for sure. He kept us safe. I don't know if you remember, Donald. You remember the rubble? You remember the firefighter with his arms around it? He sent a clear signal that the United States would be strong and fight Islamic terrorism, and he did keep us safe.
I don't know. You feel safe right now? I don't feel so safe.
Donald Trump doesn't feel so safe, and maybe a lot of other people looking around wondering about the aftermath of that as well. Andrew in Belmont, Massachusetts. Andrew, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, one of those independent voters the Republicans would love to get in their column. And after that debate, I wasn't impressed. They all stick to the same old tired Republican mantra of overturn Roe v. Wade, climate science is a hoax, we don't believe in science, give the military a blank check. There really isn't any difference between them that I can see, except for maybe Rand Paul, but he's not going to get the nomination. If Trump is the nominee, it's a gift for Hillary Clinton. Despite her email woes, Trump is unelectable. He's managed to alienate every minority group out there. And perhaps despite what your guests will say, you cannot win the White House with no minority votes. Plain and simple.
Andrew, let us pick it up right there, if I may. Lisa Desjardins, what about, I've seen this calculus out there, that at the end of the day, this comes down, back down, despite Bernie Sanders and all of his support out there right now, this comes back down to positive dynamics for Hillary Clinton.
If I understand correctly where you're going with that,
Our caller says, look, Donald Trump is in the lead. He can't ultimately win it. Republicans haven't moved enough beyond where Mitt Romney was. It didn't win last time.
Right.
If it comes back to the Democratic Party, I guess he's assuming that Bernie won't hang in the lead in the
right.
areas where he is now,
and
naturally Clinton. And yeah,
sure. I think his point about that, can you win the presidency without minority voters, is such a valid point. I'm going to disappoint him by agreeing with your caller, with Andrew in Massachusetts. And if you look at, for example, a lot of folks talk about women voters and how Democrats have won with women voters and that that's their big advantage. But the truth is, if you look deeper at those statistics, it is actually a racial gap, that Republicans are winning with white women, but Democrats are winning by such a huge margin with non-white women that it overcomes the Republican advantage with white women. And so really, I think the Democratic advantage with minorities is already massive, and a candidate like Donald Trump helps fan that. So Democrats love it. I think Andrew has a very good point here. But I think when we look at the dynamics for Hillary Clinton, she also has some very serious challenges. She's the ultimate insider, if you think about it. She also has clear problems with likability. And as we've seen in recent polls, her versus Sanders, currently she's starting to lose her support among Democratic women, which I think is probably a surprise to people and something that the Clinton campaign is taking very seriously.
Let's go to Tim in Pontiac, Michigan. Tim, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to mention that it was refreshing to see a candidate cross the ideological divide to provide a different perspective to a conservative ideology when Bernie Sanders went to Liberty University.
Yeah.
Also, he was the only Democrat that accepted the invitation to speak at Liberty University. And I think that really reflects highly on the populist persona that Bernie has taken on.
That was it seemed like a smart move to say, look, we've got to at least talk. Tim, do you think he'll actually win any votes on that side of the aisle, or is it more a signal to the rest of the country? How do you look at it?
I see it as an attempt to gain some votes from that sort of ideology. But whether or not it was going to be successful in converting a lot of minds and hearts over to his side may not be the case, as they're probably pretty entrenched with their ideology as it is.
We're looking at a week in the news, including Bernie Sanders at Liberty University, Jerry Falwell's founded school there. Here was Sanders there at Liberty U, appealing to those of differing views, a lot of them in that stadium, to look with him for common ground.
The issues of abortion and gay marriage are issues that you feel very strongly about. We disagree on those issues. I get that. But let me respectfully suggest that there are other issues out there that are of enormous consequence to our country and, in fact, to the entire world. that maybe, just maybe, we do not disagree on.
And then looking out in that hall full of Christians, it's a Christian school, he talked about economic inequality, about justice, and morality. Bernie Sanders, at Liberty U again.
There is no justice, and morality suffers when in our wealthy country, millions of children go to bed hungry. That is not morality. And that, in my view, is not what America should be about.
Jack Beatty, purely a symbolic gesture, or is there room for a kind of rejiggering of American political chemistry here that Bernie Sanders is poking at, going to?
Well, you know, he was seeking common ground on what he called family values. He said, I want you to think, whether you believe it is a family value or not, that the United States is the only major country on earth that does not provide paid family and medical leave. End quote. Polls suggest there is common ground on such issues. 77% of Republicans agree with 85% of Americans that employers should be required to offer paid sick leave. 71% of Republicans agree with 80% of Americans that employers should offer paid maternity leave. 50% of Republicans agree with 71% that the minimum wage should be raised. Republicans agree with most Americans that taxes should be raised on millionaires, and especially they agree that taxes should be raised on the rich to preserve Social Security. None of these positions are favored by the GOP elites, and neither, of course, are the outsider candidates. It's as if the GOP establishment is all hat and no cattle.
But Ramesh, you've been writing recently that Bernie Sanders can sound like a Republican in his criticism of President Obama. Interesting, Obama came out in his at the Business Roundtable on Wednesday, kind of giving a jab to Donald Trump in his Make America Great line. Obama saying, hey, America's great right now. Here he was.
Despite the perennial doom and gloom that I guess is inevitably part of a presidential campaign, America's winning right now. America's great right now.
The sitting president, Barack Obama. But Ramesh, you quote Bernie Sanders where he talks about a fifth of children living in poverty, unemployment among youth at tragically high levels, U.S. jailing more people than any other country on earth, a rigged economy. And you say this could almost be a Republican attack on the Obama years.
That's right. You certainly don't get the sense from Bernie Sanders' speech at Liberty University that he thinks that we are living in a moment of national greatness. And I think it's a real problem for the Democratic Party trying to extend a two-term streak in the White House that you don't have that level of satisfaction with the direction of the country right now. And that, I think, is what Sanders is responding to. And it's also what Donald Trump is responding to. It's part of why he's shown such great appeal is because people don't feel that happy days are here again after the Obama presidency. And so while Bernie Sanders may have been building bridges to conservative Christians, he didn't seem particularly interested in building a bridge to the Obama administration.
We remember still, Lisa, when Bill Clinton left office and that long walk he took to the stage of the Democratic nominating convention didn't work out so well in the end with courts and everything else for Al Gore. But it was a triumphant kind of walk. Is there room for the Democrats to give that to Barack Obama as they head into the election season next year? Or is it going to have to be the Bernie Sanders, things are not so great?
You know, I think there is some room for that. I think there'll be even more room in 4 years when Barack Obama is 4 years away from his presidency. I think we see that with presidents. They become more popular sometimes as we get farther away from their presidency. It's true of Reagan, true of Clinton, true of all of them. I think with Bernie Sanders, the real key to remember about him and what makes him unique in the field, he's running two campaigns. One is for president, and he's doing well with that. But the other is on his issues. And to try and change the entire conversation, really the tectonic plates of what we talk about in politics. And it's interesting to note, after Liberty, where did he go? Manassas, Virginia. This was not just a one-shot deal. He really is trying to reach out across the spectrum and change the conversation.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, 14-year-old Ahmed Mohammed was arrested at his school in Irving, Texas, over a clock he made that his teacher feared was a bomb. He won the attention of everyone from President Obama to Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg.
I'm the person who built a clock and got in a lot of trouble for it. I built the clock to impress my teacher, but when I showed it to her, she thought it was a threat to her.
Oh boy, now he's invited to the White House. Speaking of Zuck, news out of Facebook, a dislike button is in the works.
People have asked about the dislike button for many years, and probably hundreds of people have asked about this, and today is a special day, because today is the day where I actually get to say that we're working on it, and are very close to shipping a test of it.
In 2015, it's news, a dislike button on Facebook, and call it Damonsplaining. Matt Damon criticized after an exchange with African-American film producer Effie Brown. Damon suggested diversity is important when it comes to casting films, but not when it comes to hiring people behind the camera.
When we're talking about diversity, you do it in the casting of the film, not in the casting of the show.
Whew. Wow. Okay.
Oof. Wow. Okay. It's Effie Brown's comment right there. We're looking at a week in the news with Ramesh Ponnaroo of Bloomberg Views and National Review. Lisa Desjardins, a PBS NewsHour political director there, is with us. Jack Beatty's here, and you can join us. What do you think? Will Congress shut down the government over Planned Parenthood? Should it? And what do you think of borders going back up in Europe, of migrants, refugees getting gassed and water cannoned in Hungary? What are you thinking about Ahmed Mohammed and his clock in Texas? We're revving up in a hurry now for a short stretch of days in which Congress will or will not keep the government going. There are Republicans all over the map on shutting it down over Planned Parenthood, over abortion. Here's a bit of a montage. Republican Congressman Richard Hudson of North Carolina, John Fleming of Louisiana, Charlie Dent of Pennsylvania, talking with NPR's Elisa Chang this week about defunding Planned Parenthood or holding that, the government funding hostage to that. You'll hear Hudson, then Fleming, then Dent.
I'm for defunding this practice, and the best strategy to do that is what I'm for, and I'm not sure we're sure what that is. I know we're not sure what that is yet.
There's not just one step to victory here. This may have to be incremental.
The engines of the plane are revving right now on the runway, and there's a plan to take it up in the air, but there's no plan as where to land it.
Lisa Desjardins, what do you see coming on government funding and this ongoing brouhaha on Capitol Hill over Planned Parenthood?
There's certainly a lot of thinking. There's even a lot of overthinking among especially House Republicans right now on this issue. And the truth is that there is not a plan right now. And I think the arrival of the pontiff next week also creates problems in terms of the timeline here.
For
I think
whom,
what will happen? For most, pretty much everyone, for Congress and also for the president, in that the deadline to keep government funded is September 30th. Between now and then, technically, Congress only has 6 days in session on the books, but 3 of those are when the Pope is here, and we don't really expect there to be a lot of great activity next week. So that leaves us really with 3 days right before the deadline when all of this needs to be resolved. You know, I can go back and forth. Nancy Pelosi was meeting with John Boehner last night. They came out of that meeting with no solution. When you get down to the bottom line here, it looks like yet again, Speaker Boehner will need some Democratic votes to keep government funded. So then Democrats have to figure out how do they play their hand. Republicans have painted themselves into a bit of a corner, but it's over an issue that many of them care about a lot, Planned Parenthood. But we see now a split within that Freedom Caucus. Some of them call them, the Democrats call the Hell No Caucus, where they're starting to wonder, is this strategy worth it, or are we just making our party look like we're obstructionists? Are Democrats winning kind of on the overall perception game with this? Now, take all that apart. Do we have a government shutdown? Do we not? I think the best money is on they do a short-term funding bill, kick it down the road. But to be honest, I don't know. I think there is a real chance right now that we have a potential shutdown because things are just too confused and there's not a plan yet.
This thing is so fraught. We want to be very precise with the language. Republican candidates have talked about selling fetal tissue, Planned Parenthood points out. It charges for handling costs and more there. That is legal under the law. But that video, kind of very political video that came out, has people's emotions really riled on this and some not willing to let it go. David in Woodbury, Connecticut. David, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom. Hi, everybody. A government shutdown, the imposition of a government shutdown is by nature undemocratic because it gives one branch of one political party the ability to arbitrarily impose a situation damaging to our nation, to our people, and our reputation worldwide.
Well, were you thinking the same thing when a minority backed the president on the Iran deal, David?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, the Iran deal essentially went through with minority support in Congress. Were you making the same objection there?
Oh, goodness. I can't give an opinion on that. I'm sorry.
But we got it on government shutdown. Ramesh, a fair tactic? A tactic that's likely to be pursued? How do you see it?
Well, I think that we would be better off if Congress were to act on proposals that have been made over the years to prevent government shutdowns from being able to happen, that you should have a law that says if funding has expired, agencies can continue at a low level, that they continue at last year's spending level, for example. And so you take this this perennial problem off the table. Now, if you think back to the last shutdown in October of 2013, one thing that you had then that you don't have now is conservative groups spent August holding rallies and mobilizing grassroots conservative support for the tactic of using a government shutdown to defund Obamacare. You didn't see anything like that mobilization behind this tactic this time around. And that's one reason for thinking that it doesn't have the same momentum that it did back then. The congressional Republican leadership is more united on the idea, more resolute on the idea that they don't want to relive the shutdown. And I think they speak for most Republican members on that, but they're not, as Lisa was saying, they're not going to be able to get all of their troops in line for that, and they are going to need some Democratic votes.
Jack? Tom, let me just jump in really quickly. Yeah. I think what we see here, too, is a divide in strategy. Even though the Republican sort of establishment and the structure here in Washington is not organizing rallies, which is a great point by Ramesh, we see in sort of around this country, those opposed to Planned Parenthood have on their own, I think separate from the elected officials in the Republican Party, organized rallies all around the country, and that's where this pressure is coming from. It's a grassroots pressure, and it, to be honest, it's not connected to necessarily the political infrastructure here, and that's why I think we have such a difficult moment for Republicans.
Jack, how do you see this playing out, and how do you see it playing through the visit of Pope Francis, who, while he is very tough on climate change and on some of the extremes of capitalism, calling for structural change all over the place, has not moved away from the Catholic Church's position on abortion. Got a lot of politics and a pope coming up this week.
That's going to be quite a sight. To get back to what Ramesh was saying, there's another difference between 2013 and now. What really saved the Republicans from what would have been a lingering disaster, the shutdown and all the examination of it, was the snafu, the breakdown of the website handling Obamacare. That was a rescue for them. Suddenly, all the attention. That's not likely to happen again. And they have to keep that in mind. You know, Mitch McConnell has said there's no education in that second kick of a mule. Well, I think John Boehner is hoping for the same thing. But with the people will get the point of that. But the Pope, you know, people have said that he tried to take the focus off to abortion issues and gender issues with statements earlier last week in the Vatican about, women who have had an abortion can be forgiven mm-hmm. in the Czech Catholic Church and so on. And he did that so that he could address the economic issues if speaking in the United States. Well, if that's the case, that can't help the Republicans, since his message is essentially Bernie Sanders' message squared.
Let's go to Jordan in Bowling Green, Kentucky. Bernie Sanders squared. Okay. Jordan in Bowling Green, Kentucky, you're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to talk about the fact that the Republican Party wanting to shut down the government over defunding Planned Parenthood is indicative of, like, a general hypocrisy of the party and just pretty much ignoring the fact that Planned Parenthood is so important for so many women. And I live in the state of Kentucky, and the closest Planned Parenthood to Bowling Green is in Louisville, which is an hour and a half away.
Wow.
And that Planned Parenthood is in downtown Louisville. It services many women in, like, an urban city, and the fact that something like that could shut down basically because a few people in an elitist group decide that abortions are wrong. Like,
who are you calling elitist, Jordan? Elitist gets thrown around every which way these days. Who are you calling elitist?
I feel like, as a young woman, as a 22-year-old woman, mm-hmm. that I pay for my own birth control and all those things, like, it comes to me as the fact that a lot of, you know, older white men in the Republican Party want to judge on the morality of what's going on. And Planned Parenthood is so much more than abortions anyway. So why defund something that's good for women?
Jordan, I appreciate your call. Ramesh, I don't know if you've counted the noses, but is there any scenario that you see, Ramesh, in which Planned Parenthood actually loses its funding, its federal funding here?
Well, you know, I think an interesting avenue to that was opened up this week without, I think, getting a lot of attention. During the debate, Governor Bush suggested reviving a rule that the Reagan administration had imposed at the end of its time in office, which is that the law that bans abortion funding from Title X, the family planning subsidy, means that you can't be co-located with abortion clinics. And basically, if you're performing abortions, you can't get that money. That means that a Republican president would be able to do this without passing a law and certainly without shutting down the government. It'll be interesting to see whether other Republicans take up that issue because certainly support among Republicans for the general principle that you shouldn't have taxpayer funding for the largest abortion provider in this country, which is Planned Parenthood, is very strong.
I want to pull back and look abroad just for a second here. Interesting moves this week by Russia over Syria, where the violence and chaos has been so deep, where the Islamic State has made a lot of inroads and the world hasn't known quite what to do about it, where Assad hangs in after all these years. Here's a press conference on Tuesday, Russian President Vladimir Putin defending Russia's military support of the Assad Syrian government, saying that without it, the refugee crisis in Europe would be worse. Putin saying, we've supported the Syrian government. I'd like to say, as it confronts a terrorist organization, we provided and will provide all the necessary military and technical support, and we call on other countries to join us. And then the sound of Americans responding in news today that it looks like the U.S. will begin military talks with Russia some kind of cooperation in Syria. At a Wednesday press conference, here was Secretary of State John Kerry.
Obviously, there are serious questions about that. I'm not taking that at face value because we look at the type of airplanes or the type of munitions and so forth, and it obviously raises much more serious questions about what is happening.
They're talking about the characterization of the kind of military equipment that Russia has been moving into Syria, whether it is really for fighting the Islamic State terrorists or others. Jack Beatty, what do you see unfolding here? The U.S. now apparently willing to talk about this. What is Putin going for in getting militarily engaged in this very messy situation?
Well, he's changing the subject. The subject was Ukraine. Now when he speaks at the UN, is it next week or the week after, he's going to say, let's have an international coalition against this dreadful terrorism in Syria. Join me. Join our country in fighting against these savages. Well, it'll give him something else to say. Meanwhile, the things in Ukraine are slightly calmer than they were. People had feared that there was going to be a kind of, you know, big surge out of the rebel enclaves into the rest of Ukraine. That hasn't happened. And so I think this is partly to do with just his own positioning on the international stage. It has to be comforting, though, that our military is talking to their military. We don't want them colliding. We don't want our planes. That could just be a disaster. We don't want anything like that.
And yet, if you got this long kind of pool game, complicated shot here, where Putin's looking at the refugees and that pressure on Europe's borders, takes it back to Syria, somehow gets the U.S. and Europe to lay off him, take the pressure off in Ukraine, to deal with the fence going up in Hungary. It got pretty ugly in Hungary this week. They had water cannon. They had gas on those refugees. Here was Ban Ki-moon, U.N. Secretary General at the U.N., condemning the Hungarian government's treatment of refugees, migrants on its borders.
I ask those standing in the way of the rights of refugees to stand in their shoes. People facing barrel bombs, brutality in their country will continue to seek life in another.
Ramesh Panaru, borders going back up in Europe this week. This was one of the major hallmarks of the EU, that there were not borders. What do you see unfolding in the migrant crisis at this point, Ramesh?
Well, it's a huge issue that brings a lot of different problems that Europe is having together, one being the questionable legitimacy of some of the supranational governance in Europe, at least as experienced by European people who don't think that the EU should be setting immigration policy for every country in the region, who don't think that Chancellor Merkel should be setting immigration policy for every country in the region. And then there's the demographic problem that Europe sort of, I think, is beginning to feel a little bit more demographically embattled and fearful about its neighbors to the south and southeast. So all this is coming together, and you have a European Union response, which I think is just sort of making things up as they go along in a way that is disconcerting a lot of people.
Europe has its problems, wrestling with them there. They can spill into American foreign policy. We have our problem as well. St. Louis out with the Ferguson Commission report this week, looking at racial and economic gaps in the St. Louis area, calling for big reforms there. Much undone business right across the board. Ramesh Panaru, Bloomberg View, National Review, great to have you with us today. Thank you so much for joining us, Ramesh.
You're welcome.
Lisa Desjardins, political director for the PBS NewsHour. Lisa, it's always great to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And Jack Beatty, thank you as always, sir.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. Thanks for joining us today. This is On Point.